rectangulaire de Freaksville Record.
Well, shall I go by this list and talk about fandom English?
You are not obliged to.
No, well, I might as well if it.
You can choose or pick up something else. Yeah.
Well, I might as well start on this. The editorial on fan institutions and the SFWA and, you know, the kind of professional group was really directed at America and Britain chiefly. Yes. And in fact, I say in the editorial that at one time they served a useful purpose, but now they've become so reactionary a force that
sense?
Even in simple sort of political terms you know, the majority of the people appear to be either completely apolitical or you know, reactionary in their sort of tastes. Yes.
In that case we have the same problem in France. For instance, in Galaxy, all the letters are about politics in science fiction.
Yeah.
But we have another problem with the fandom. This is a problem of quality, you know. The quality of the fans' text are very low.
Mm.
And we try to do something, but I don't know why. It's very difficult.
Well, it's the same here. Very, very similar thing. There's some, you know, few things. But I mean, here you tend to get the kind of the fans who are kind of good at expressing themselves have got a much bigger professional market anyway, so that they find that they kind of, you know, get into the professional market much sooner. Whereas obviously in France it's mainly sort of uptown and, you know, and the mainly reprints of American and British. I think that they somehow here and in America do have this kind of repressive force on the kind of quality, the literary quality of science fiction. But in countries, say, where there still isn't a sort of established vocabulary, you know, apart from anything else, and a large commercial market, the kind of the fan element is, you know, is fine. It's just that it tends to remain, certainly in Britain and America, its tastes are based very much on the 50s. The standards that it and ideas that it promotes are of the 50s. So that, and I've seen this happen with good writers, individual writers, who've been sort of trapped in, you know, in the whole. There's universities teaching it. There's, you know, there's courses in all American universities. There's courses in English universities and so on. And it's a kind of dead hand that's you know.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, I just do react against that. Whereas, you know, I'm in correspondence with sort of fans in South and Central America. On the continent, and it's just not the same. I mean, many of these people are kind of very literate, often sort of translators and things like that. And, you know, it'll be a long time before those institutions start to become rigid. So I wasn't really I wasn't attacking it for what it was, say in the 40s and 50s, but really for what it's become in the 70s.
Is there a progressive fandom in England?
Not really. You get a few correspondences. But the institutions themselves, the clubs and the conventions and so on, you know, tend to...
Yes, I was in the World Convention of Heidelberg.
Yeah.
This was very funny.
Look, one thing is that most of these people only read science fiction, so that they're virtually illiterate. They've got no reference points outside of it. They read it for escape, only.
For escape.
Yeah. So that whereas at the same time they're claiming that it's that the ideas are brilliant and so on. They don't know any other ideas, so they're really in a kind of primitive, almost, you know. State of a kind of primitive society that depends almost wholly on its myths for its literature, and in that sense, you know, it's a kind of weird kind of subculture, which, you know, it's very hard to.
Yes, you have just speaking about escape. What do you want to? To do in science fiction?
Well, the elements of escapist fiction, the speed, the to some extent the emphasis on action, I think are good because they're popular, they have immediate appeal, in fact, you know, to all kinds of people. But I feel, you know, there's a need to incorporate that with a much more sophisticated look at the subject matter, that it just has to be more profound, better informed, so that the Jerry Cornelius things are an attempt to combine, you know, good fun with you know, with a lot of ideas.
I think that the stories of Jerry Cornelius are completely different from your other stories.
Yes, yeah.
Yes.
But I tend, even in the sword and sorcery books, I often get in a kind of moral point, which kind of, I hope, you know, is inclined to sort of counterbalance. And there's irony in them too, which, you know, is an attempt to counterbalance.
Yeah. About heroic fantasy, I ask a question here.
Right, yes, agree. I wrote an article in Friends magazine in which I wasn't talking specifically about heroic fantasy, I was mainly talking about Heinlein, in which I said it was very strange that the libertarians or self-styled libertarians in America, that their main, or at least one of their main enthusiasms was, you know, reactionary Robert Heinlein.
Yes.
And that, in a sense, I mean, it comes down to the kind of authoritarianism of Heinlein has an appeal in, you know, for people who would really want to be, you know, authoritarians themselves, like hardline communists and that kind of... and I remember a long time ago, mentioning anarchists, there was an article, long article in Freedom, or Anarchist Monthly, I think it was. It was a sort of official old anarchist thing on Heinlein, in which Heinlein was presented as a radical left wing writer, and this included Starship Troopers. So I think it does boil down to the fact that you get two kinds of libertarians. You get the kind of the dispossessed who really want to be boss, and you get the kind of true libertarians who just want everybody, you know, to be the same. You always get these clashes in politics, in political groups. I mean, even though they're under the same banner, the divisions often go that way. I mean, sort of Bolsheviks and Mensheviks to some extent, and certainly Trotskyites and you know, sort of hardline communists. So I think that's probably, you know, if it's an explanation, it explains the dichotomy of, you know, that you get in this. Also, I mean, if you've got kind of, if you've formulated moral principles and political principles, it's sometimes nice to relax and just read something that, that kind of denies those principles, as long as you see it in its place. If you, you know, if the heroic fantasy is 2 hours of fun, you know, just escapism, there probably isn't anything wrong in that. I mean, you know, the way you read thrillers or, you know, anything else, it's a... the only place where it becomes kind of politically confusing is where it deals kind of in specific sort of social political themes and disguises, you know, it's fascism by pretending to be liberal. And I think a lot of science fiction does that. The sort of stuff that, what's his name, we did the introduction to my Ulrich book, Bergier, is it? Bergier. Jacques Bergier.
Yes.
I think that, you know, there's a...
in the case of Bergier, it's another thing is completely mad.
Yeah. The imagery of heroic fantasy, I mean, it's so close to the imagery of Nazi, you know, the kind of, you know, Nazi swords and, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Norman Spinrad's written a book that's coming out this year in the States called Sword of the Third Reich, which is allegedly a heroic fantasy written by Adolf Hitler, in which he sees the whole kind of heroic fantasy thing as Hitler's wish fulfillment. It's quite a nice idea. And he's going to...
Do you want to drink something?
Oh, well... Oh, I haven't got any scotch, I'm afraid. I've got some glasses. Fiction. And in... 2 months, that's just...
Yes. There was also another group, a Spanish group, very interesting, who were editing a very good magazine, a professional magazine, Nueva Dimension. Yes.
Yeah, I...
This was really one of the best magazines I have, but... they cannot continue.
Yeah. As a license.
For,
yes. Yeah.
For political.
Yeah, right. And,
have you had problems with...
Not with the new one at all. The new one, the magazine, you mean? Or,
yes.
Yeah. No, only previously and, you know, it's old history, really. With kind of British style, quiet censorship, which is really individuals deciding they don't like it. There was a in the House of Commons a right wing MP asked. He said something like, you know, when the Arts Council was supporting you, well, you know, should this money, you know, be spent on rubbish like this? And the Jenny Lee, who was then Minister of Arts, answered it, but it was a very equivocal, careful answer, more or less saying, you know, that it would continue. But we haven't really, I mean, New Worlds wasn't involved in politics deliberately. It was a sort of...
Not directly?
No, no. It was a sort of artistic science and, you know,
yes.
Much more a broad sort of moral experiment than a...
But for me, it was evident that there is a political aspect.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, most of the people on it are left-wing, and you can't kind of avoid, really,
yeah.
You know, favouring certain things. Although people like Ballard really aren't... are either completely apolitical or, in many opinions, quite conservative, if not right-wing. You know, there's very little conversation, political conversation, you know, can take place there. But again, you know, a writer that's kind of trying to deal with sort of human beings and kind of the problems of the society and so on is bound not to be, if he's analysing as opposed to imposing, which I think is probably what kind of New World science fiction was trying to be, instead of kind of imposing a set of ideas how the world should be, we were trying to analyse, you know, what it was. You're bound to kind of get what would, you know, automatically be a sort of left-wing bias, in that, you know, I mean, it kind of sends you in that direction without you necessarily wanting to. I know, as a writer, the more I think about ordinary problems of society, the more left-wing politically I get, although it doesn't go into the writing. I'm virtually a Maoist, you know, just by sort of logic, just sort of leads in that general direction, although I have no particular hope for anything.
Well, for instance, for me, it was political to speak of William Burroughs' books. And it is funny when you said that Ballard is sometimes on the right wing.
Yeah, and this is in kind of areas that aren't important areas. I mean, it's probably slightly racialistic. I mean, not in a, you know, I mean, he's nervous of Negroes, say. And, you know, I don't want to sort of go too far, because it would be, I don't want to, you know, can, you know, say anything that...
Ballard liked very much William Burroughs.
Yes, yeah. But then Burroughs, in many ways, is kind of, you know, very...
Yes,
weird.
But,
I think, you know, I think actually that Ballard is sort of essentially radical in many of his attitudes. It's only superficially that he's got kind of, they're sort of easy,
yes,
views to hold socially, you know. You know, they don't. It's sort of conversational views rather than deeply, you know, profoundly held views. I mean, his profound views would go completely contrary to you know, to the odd expression of right wing.
For me also, Thomas Dietz in a concentration camp was very political.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps not directly, but...
Well, Dietz, who's probably my closest friend, isn't very radical. Certainly not. I mean, he is apolitical. He doesn't really believe in politics.
Yes.
His morality, his actual moral kind of ethical analysis, you know, as a writer, makes him radical, but he's often said, you know, that it's very attractive, the idea of being a redneck American, you know, conservative. It's a sort of attraction that he feels he might easily. but again, you know, it's always a conflict. It's like, and this is why you often get conflicting statements from writers whose work, well, equally Heinlein has claimed that he's a communist. so that, you know, you get the two.
But do you think science fiction must be radical?
Well, I think that all good fiction is. No, that's not fair. All analytical fiction is perforce, radical in the broad sense. Or if it, I think that kind of the British tradition of science fiction, which many American writers, you know, are in. Just as many British writers are in the American tradition, but it derives, you know, from kind of this sort of European moral tradition, so that the writers are very much in the same, you know, they're still in the kind of in that moral tradition of analysis and you know, working out moral problems, whereas American literature is in many ways dependent on a different. There are sort of different things kind of behind it, so that it's almost a convention of much American fiction to hold a view and make a fiction which supports that view, whereas if you're of a different temperament and you don't know what your views are. You know, you've no kind of. You're just more kind of uncertain of, you know, if there are any views to hold. You just take an entirely different approach. So the clash between the old wave and the new wave, which, you know, doesn't really exist anyway, is much to do with this kind of this situation, and because the temperaments of the people are so different, there's never going to be any great equilibrium sort of established between them. They'll know, you know, they're not going to understand each other's points of view. You know, you get this with most of the American writers, like Van Vogt, and they've got very well-established views, which they've never changed, and their entire life and their writing is spent in reinforcing, you know, supporting those views. It's probably to do with, you know.
Do you think it is possible to change something in our society now? And do you know if science fiction can do something for that?
I think if science fiction's done anything, it's produced greater confusion. Traditional science fiction, anyway, you know, kind of American pulp-derived science fiction, has probably done more to increase the sort of fantasy quotient in society than any other thing recently. I mean, if the world is confused, if the world is more confused now than it was, I don't know if it is. I think that, you know, Robert Heinlein and James Blish have done their bit to add to the confusion.
James Blish is on the right wing?
I don't think so. I think he'd regard himself as being liberal.
Yes.
Yeah. And Fred Pohl. But many of the people that I like that I know who regard themselves as liberals, I
of political, for instance, the novel you write with Kondrut, the spokesman, was one of I prefer, because
you
analyze the society.
Yes. Well, I was disappointed in that because I felt that it didn't go deep enough. That
yes.
It kind of argued against advertising, but it didn't argue against the state, which produces, you know, the advertising and the, you know, all the rest of it.
Yes. For me, it was just the first step.
Yeah, right.
Because when I was reading the book, my ideas were not as radical as now.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. Well, me too, I think.
And I think this sort of book is very important sometimes.
Yeah.
That depends on the situation.
Yes, I agree. Yes. Yeah, I think, and see, that in many ways was the kind of the height of American science fiction. Was it was at its best during McCarthy, you know, the McCarthy era, the 50s,
yes.
When it had a kind of, you know, clear enemy and the sort of state of society around it. And in fact, it was the only fiction, popular fiction, which was making any attempt at all to counteract. Yes, I mean, I became. Sorry, go on.
For instance, I think that comics now are very important because they publish, they are more radical than yesterday.
Yes. I still.
For instance, Marvel Comics put in their stories some new ideas. Not completely radical, but it's a first step.
Yeah. No, sorry.
They are important because they are important because children read them.
Yeah. I'd say there was an actual contradiction in that, though, in that, well, personally speaking,
yes,
the idea of the hero is essentially
yes.
So that you kind of got this, I mean, in a way, the kind of the hero politician leads to a kind of authoritarian view of politics, of, you know, of the world. I think this is the only objection that I've got. I mean, it's not a strong one. It's not an important.
Yes, but in the case of the superheroes, they are not really superheroes because they are nearly mad.
Yeah.
For instance, Spider-Man and other heroes.
Yes,
and
sure.
I don't know if the hero is reactionary, really.
Well, no, agreed. The hero in literature isn't reactionary, but I think the hero in politics is. Well, as I mean, the sort of big question that I'm always sort of trying to think about is that it seems to me a kind of sort of logical confusions which sort of lead to the confusion between a poet and a politician.
Thank you very much. What is it?
It's crystal acrylic.
Is it? Where did you get it?
And it's more real than the other.
Mm. Very good.
She's one of your daughters. How old are you?
32. I'm getting old.
I have a friend who physically is nearly like you.
Who's that? As a matter of interest, what's his name?
He's French. René Nicolas.
Ah. Well, there's somebody, another Frenchman who's physically almost my double, called...
Yes, I know the number. In Paris.
Bizot, who does Actuel. It's strange, when he came here...
But he have no...
No beard. But,
yes, I know.
Hilary, my wife... knew me before I had a beard, and she saw, and she just sort of, you know, exclaimed, and he didn't realise, because, you know, with the beard, he kind of didn't, and he was very sort of...
He made an interview?
Not really, he was mainly interested in, at that time, in reprinting, yeah, but I don't think...
I think when also, I speak with him about your work.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
No. Not very much. I didn't came.
Excuse me.
Very little came of the, you know, the talk we had. He was originally wanting to do a sort of ballad and the Cornelius things and things like that. But I think they've probably gone more.
He has published the text. By Alan Ellison.
Really? Oh, that's right. Yes, he's talking about it.
And all those are not remember. Wait. They aren't very much science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Well.
Oh, right. The underground.
Yes, the underground.
Yeah.
What do you think of underground?
There are quite a lot of affinities between the sort of New Worlds group and the underground. I mean, for instance, Ballard and me and Dish certainly have all been published in underground magazines. You know, they've kind of asked us for stuff. I think IT did the ballad thing in one of its very editions. But the New World's attitude towards the underground has kind of been very much up and down. Sometimes been quite close, and other times. And I think now there's a much closer affinity with a lot of the people, you know, in the underground. Partly because those people perhaps are a bit older. They've sorted out a lot of their problems. They're more mature in the way they kind of handle things. They've got a better, you know. So at the moment we're you know, there's quite a strong conjunction. And I write quite a lot for friends and a bit for IT, have done.
Yeah. I've not seen your your articles in France?
I don't do them under my own name. They come out. They're usually signed Cornelius, Frank Cornelius, Catherine Cornelius.
I'm just on the 5 or 6 copies
yeah.
in France. It's very difficult to find.
Yes, right. It's quite difficult to find in England. Mike Harrison, who does most of our criticism, was doing a fairly regular critical column in France.
And we reprint the paper from an interview of Frank Herbert.
Really?
Yes. And it's a good interview. Mainly about ecology, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know they'd done that. So, you know, me and Mike Harrison, really, because we're involved, I mean, I'm involved in this community, and this community happens to be the main sort of centre of sort of underground activities, so I just find myself naturally involved in things, like doing a petition against the Night Assemblies Bill, or
what?
The Night Assemblies Bill, which is an attempt to stop big concerts, big festivals, big rock festivals.
We have not this problem because it's impossible to have a big festival.
Well, it's getting that. I don't think this bill will be passed. I don't think it'll be made law. But nonetheless, you know, you have to do something. It's a kind of a question of sort of liberty being nothing to do really with rock and roll, but just the idea of the state trying to stop people. And I did something for the White Panther magazine.
Yes, I certainly will contact the White Panthers.
They're quite nice.
They are still living in England.
Yeah, well, there's a number.
In America,
mm-hmm.
also?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think it is one of the best groups.
Yes, it is. It does a lot of good community work, too.
Yes.
Like free food and things like that.
Yes, in France, there is nothing very interesting in political groups. But there was a movement called Situationist.
Right, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think of this movement?
Well, I don't know much about it, the French...
Me also, I'm just reading...
Yeah, the principles, I find very appealing, but...
They are very good because they are anti-dogmatic.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And for me, that is the first... Yeah. Idea, because if you can change if you make an error.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, I think
in France, nearly all groups are dogmatics.
Yeah.
Even anarchists.
Yes. Right. Well, I think it's almost always been the case in France. There's kind of sort of logic kind of narrowing.
Yes.
Most of the people that I get on with in the underground are obviously a lot of dogmatic people. Friends, for instance, there was an attempt to take over Friends by the hard dogmatic political wing, which was countered by the Situationist wing, if you like.
They are dogmatic, or...?
Well, some of them are. I mean, it's like every group, as I was saying earlier, that half of them will be like that, and the other half will be...
They are dogmatic in what way? For instance, they want to take the power?
Yes, they're sort of straightforward Marxists,
yes.
Old-fashioned Marxists.
Yes.
Whereas the other people on Friends magazine argue that there's already a lot of magazines of that kind doing that kind of work, and so they want to do something which is much more open and allows for many more shades of opinion.
Reading Friends, I wasn't very conscious that they were dogmatic.
Well,
for me, on the contrary, they were not. But I think it is because I'm French and the situation in France is more than dogmatic.
Yes, Well, Friends goes up and down. Sometimes it's more dogmatic.
Yes.
And then, you know, there's a kind of shift and they become more open. Now, they're more open and presumably will be for a while until somebody else tries to, you know, to narrow it down.
In France, they are so dogmatic that, for instance, Maoists are to go into a factory,
mm-hmm.
they can fight against workers.
Yeah.
This is completely
bad. Yes. Yeah.
Only to go into the factory.
Mm-hmm. Hillary? Hmm. Which one?
Yeah. I just wanted to know if Mrs. Lopez could come
and not today. Yeah. There's no need. She's been twice this week. I think the other reason why there are kind of affinities with what you could call the situationist underground is that a writer can't be that committed, so that the kind of literary principles that, you know, that you've got find a more sympathy with situationists, simply because, you know, it's what you're doing in your writing. You can't have a strong opinion, or at least you can't sort of form a strong political opinion, because it would be silly. It would kind of leave out whole areas of experience. So, well, there's a kind of a general sympathy with the left, and you're inclined to favour the left as opposed to the right. Really, the kind of uncommitted anarchist and situationist is where you sort of find much more agreement. I think that's probably why I personally, in my personal relationships with people in the underground, get on best with those people, and really don't get on very well with the political people, because I find they're shouting too much. The policy of the underground people that I get on with is. Really, the Angry Brigade is a good example, but nobody belongs to the Angry Brigade, and everybody belongs to the Angry Brigade. So you can say you're, you know, Angry Brigade, and the authorities, the sort of establishment, are constantly looking for these political organisations which don't exist. Yeah.
This is the anarchist movement in theory.
Mm.
In theory, because. Well, on another side, there is an anti-rationalist aspect in the underground.
Yeah, I don't have much sympathy with that.
For instance,
I mean, again,
religion.
Yeah,
from India.
Right. A lot of my friends, a number of my friends, yes, are into that, and some of the New Worlds, or the artists particularly, because it doesn't really affect their stuff. Like Gabby Nasserman, who did a lot of the photographs in New World, very good photographs, is completely, she's got a guru, she goes to India, you know. But it's nothing to do with, luckily, with, you know.
My opinion is that it is interesting, but there is no way out.
No. In a way.
No more than dogmatic groups.
No, agreed. But there's a sympathy with people who are looking for, say, sort of spiritual values in, you know.
Yes.
But unfortunately, the mysticism itself leads them away from kind of finding the kind of spiritual aspect of ordinary human relationships, you know, between...
Yes, I think it is not a problem of mysticism. It's just a problem of consciousness.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think I'm mystic, but I'm conscious, and that changes.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, my own work is sometimes, I mean, a Christian could see my work, a lot of it anyway, even the Cornelius things, in very sort of Christian terms, if you know, if they wanted to. I don't...
For instance, I think that Henrik is very mystic in a certain,
yes,
in a certain,
yeah,
way.
Yeah. Well, again, I think it's the, you know, it's the problem of kind of finding spiritual values in a material world. Which I think is probably the only hope for people, but there's no way of promoting that. You know, you can't make people have. You know, I've been writing a lot about the British Empire, because it seems to me, as with other previous empires, the confusion deliberately promoted. Between a kind of, like a crusade, a high ideal, all the spiritual impulses are kind of channeled into, you know, conquering and exploiting and destroying cultures. I think that's, you know, if you go any way beyond just people, you immediately, you know, this happens every time. Same with politics, you know. That's really what I meant earlier when I was talking about confusion of the nature of, you know, sort of human impulses. To confuse the material with the spiritual is sort of constantly done, and it's what leads to a lot of the trouble.
What do you think about the Old Earth Catalogue?
Oh, I'm all for it. I haven't got any great thoughts about it. I think it's a good idea.
Yes, for me, it's, I think they are countries.
And yeah.
For instance, it's the Old Earth Catalogue is nearly impossible in France. it is too far from... Our underground, you know.
Yeah.
I hope that it will change,
yes.
But I'm not sure.
Yeah. I think, well, I don't know what it is really. I've often wondered about this, that America and Britain and the Scandinavian countries and the sort of even Holland, places like that, the kind of community, the sense of community is often, I don't want to overstate this because it'd be silly, but just on the evidence,
yes.
that those communities seem to cohere finally. There aren't the kind of divisions somehow. I don't know what it is. It makes for often for a blandness and a dullness, but at the same time it does. I mean, just things like when the Germans went into Denmark and all the Danes kind of immediately kind of, you know, protected all the Jews. It's a kind of this kind of community thing, and the appeal to it comes very quickly to countries, which I suppose are Anglo-Saxon in I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it is. It might be, you know, it's that kind of sort of almost a sort of inbuilt democratic sort of aspect, so that you get a reflection of this. It might be Protestantism. I, you know, no idea what.
Do you think communities can be a solution?
Can be a solution.
Yes.
I think so. Yes.
Would you like to live in a community?
No.
No. Why?
Well, effectively, I do live in a community because where I live, the people I know, the numbers of people that come here, there's an unstated sort of community, so that probably that's, you know, that's sufficient for me, just on that sort of level. Ideally, I mean, my ideals all tend towards that sort of thing, but the actual communes that I've experienced, most of them I don't feel they're based on a sort of an ideal which perhaps doesn't allow for human error or human jealousy, you know, vanity, and all those sort of things. So they kind of assume that if everybody lives in a community,
yes,
everybody will be nicer.
Yes, for me the problem is that these communities don't start on the good step.
Yes, yes.
But I think it is possible.
Yes, yeah. I wouldn't be one to emphasize the sort of the drug aspect of the thing. But the sort of the large scale use of cannabis does produce there is a tendency to relax more on you know, allow people to be themselves, you know, and not. I know, I've often said this, that I've got, as it were, two kinds of friends. I've got the kind of middle class, more or less straight, literary friends, and literate, sort of vocal, you know, friends, and underground friends. And I've often noticed that the underground friends are far less critical of the straight friends than the straight friends are of the, you know, so they're much more likely to accept and usually be kind of nicer. so that, you know, that I think, you know, if I've got any hope, my hope would be in that way of life. But it wouldn't go as far as being faith. I haven't got any faith in it. I think that it's so fragile that it can be destroyed overnight. That's, you know, it's the problem of the kind of libertarian attitude, is that the people who want power obviously are going to get power, and they'll get the guns.
For me, the first problem now is women's lib.
I've decided to become a misogynist. I've decided to become anti-feminine.
Yes.
I got fed up with it. I've always been a feminist in principle. And I suppose I still am. It's just I get fed up with the sort of liberal cant about, you know, about women's lib. I find it hard to morally to hold views on women's lib when I'm a husband of a wife with three children. So the situation would have to be radically changed. So my lifestyle would have to change, my emotional attitudes would have to change. If I wanted to follow through what sort of morally I believe is a good idea. So I thought about this and decided that while I do believe in it, that I can't morally hold too strong views on women's lib while I'm, you know, in the position that I'm in.
For me, it is a first problem because I have seen that it is the problem of the underground.
Oh, it is very much.
It is a problem of the communities.
Yes.
In fact, it is the first problem to live.
I was at a...
To live, but not in the conventional manner. It's the first problem for a person who try to live in another way.
Yes, right. This is the kind of the paradox for me of the whole thing.
But of course, I think it is the same problem in England. The French woman lib became more and more dogmatic. But
yeah.
The problem is not the movement. The problem is woman's lib.
I find it. I mean, as a writer, I find it difficult to reconcile this because the Jerry Cornelius books, again, have always promoted what I hope is a sort of anti-sexist view. I've never believed that there are very strong differences, the kind of, you know, between men and women as a whole, that you get kind of, in simple terms, you get dominant women and dominant men and passive women and passive men, that the kind of, it's to do with character, not to do with sex. But there again, you know, there are all the institutions involved, and which are obviously unfair to women, which are kind of based on a false principle. So, I mean, in sort of personal life, I don't think I try not to be a male chauvinist pig. But in many ways I am. And really I've just accepted it because I don't want to change my way of life. And with children and everything, you're kind of in this peculiar situation. I know with the children, for instance, neither of us kind of impose ideas on the children, or hope not to. And I noticed with the girls, with the two girls that I've got, one is typically feminine, I mean, in her interests, dolls and, you know, dresses and that sort of thing. while the other is much more has a much more sort of mechanical bent.
It's always the same thing when there is two girls.
Yeah. Mm. It's true.
This is very funny.
Yeah. Whereas my son is very traditionally masculine in his interests, you know, and his aggression and you know, and all the rest of it.
Yes.
So that I you know, I mean, it proves something. But I'm very confused on the issue. I used not to be, but I know some women in women's lib, you know, in the country here. I know one woman who's very sort of militant. And we spent Christmas with her. And I found it very hard, although I sympathised, I mean, agreed with her attitude. She's rich, she's an upper class woman. She had a nanny, sort of servant, to look after her children, whom she exploited horribly. And I just couldn't, you know. And then I mentioned children's lib, which is probably something I feel quite strongly about, because it seemed to me these children were being very much, you know, set aside. And she got very angry, and when I said something, they said I was being obscene and disgusting, and all this sort of, and I just gave up. You know, I think really it probably boils down to children's liberation, because that's, you know, that's you might as well start at the root of it.
I knew a community in France with servants. This is only an hotel, you know.
Yeah. I gave a talk a few years ago now, about 4 years, I think, at the University of Kent, which was on these topics, and it had all been going very well. All the men had been expressing their you know, their liberal views. And then afterwards, we went to have some coffee in a small room, in a common room. And immediately, all the men said to the girls, "Well, you know, what about getting some coffee?" And I sort of said, "You know, I just sort of said, you know." So, but even the girls didn't kind of react. It's very.
This is the old problem of the Greek democracy.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
There was a democracy, but there were also slaves.
Right, absolutely.
Okay.
If I had to produce a moral justification for writing heroic fantasy, or my own heroic fantasy, I think that's, you know, that's where I'd say that I do try to bring in a moral of that kind, you know, that you know, all is chaos, and to create the rule of law or whatever, you just have to work very hard indeed, you know, and you get very small gains. So in that sense, you know, if it's coming back to that, there is a kind of liberal moral brought over, and it's the only thing that would allow me to justify writing them. If I couldn't do that, if I had to write Conan, or, you know, the kind of standard heroic fantasy, I just wouldn't do it, because there's no, you know, it would be against I did a series of books in the manner of Edgar Rice Burroughs, set on Mars. At the end of the three books, the hero himself says to the listener, the narrator who's telling the story to you, he says, you know, don't worry about my Mars, you know, if it's refined, find the ideals in, you know, inside your own your own thing. So.
I like very much the Madish novel, Concentration Camp, because there is no moral in the conventional meaning.
Yeah.
It's just a choice.
Absolutely.
You choose to be violent or no violent, but there is no morality.
Right.
To be violent is no more moral or less moral than.
Yes. I think that's.
For me, all is a choice.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that too.
Do you accept sciences?
Yes.
The sciences now.
Not the technology.
But even technology, I think technology can be good.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I've got a lot of technology.
Yes.
I like technology. Again, the kind of underground attitude for using technology, the way Hawkwind uses it, the technology, which is to see what it'll do, kind of spontaneous sort of enjoyment of the thing.
We can use technology to be free.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
we can use also technology to be slaves.
Yes, but I mean, it's the, if you like, it's the kind of the selling of technology which is the problem, the kind of materialism, you know, where it's thought to be better to have a lot of technology than not. Again, you know, it's a choice. If you don't like it, don't use it. But if you relish it. Get as much as possible. Paolozzi, the artist, Eduardo Paolozzi, has got this sort of tremendous sort of wholehearted enjoyment of machines and gadgets, and uses it a lot in his art. And that's really the best way of doing it. When with Hawkwind.
You have seen them on stage?
Oh, right, yes, I've written some of their material. When they're around here, for instance, and there's kind of gadgets, even an electric pencil sharpener, they just kind of just enjoy seeing what they'll do, you know, turning all the knobs to see what'll happen. And initially, a lot of their music with the synthesizers and stuff was entirely a kind of almost a primitive. Sort of marvelous kind of glee, what'll happen if you turn the power up, and so on.
This isn't far from science fiction.
No, I mean, this is probably, to me, Hawkwind in particular, particularly over the last year as they've developed, is the sort of apotheosis of that kind of science fiction. I mean, they've got all the best of it and discarded the, you know, so they've got the image and the spirit without all the kind of rubbish. And on stage, they have a sort of tremendous sort of apocalyptic kind of quality, which makes a lot of the managements, you know, of the halls that they're on, very nervous of them, very frightened of them, because they think they're very nasty.
In the introduction, I want to put in my magazine. I think I will say that. science fiction can give to the underground movement, the French underground movement, science fiction can give to it rationality, love of a good rationality, and love of good technology.
Yeah.
Because in science fiction, I think we accept more easily science.
Yeah. Well, I think too, you've lived with it so long that you're used to it. You don't see it as a threat or as a kind of answer to all, you know, all the problems. That it's just a just like a lake or a tree, or you know, or anything. That it's just something you can use.
But of course, I'm against the use of technology and the present.
Yes. But there again, I mean, you're bound to get sort of good and bad. I mean, it's the human situation that you know, every good thing is a bad thing. So, you know, the atomic bomb or you know, nuclear power is a sort of pure example of you know, that paradox. You probably can't ever solve that. That if there are, if people do divide into two kinds of people, there are, you know, one kind of people is going to blow things up, and the other kind is going to sort of use the power to, you know, to make things.
And we can speak now about ecology.
Well,
because it's a problem of technology.
Yes, agreed. Well, there again, in science fiction, in sort of early post-war science fiction, ecology was quite a strong theme all the time. In Brian Aldiss's stories, he used it quite often, usually to do with the planet, and sort of one element of a planet removed produced sort of, you know, social changes and, you know, kind of ecological changes. And as perhaps, you know, the science fiction reader again is used to the idea of ecology, of the system.
Yeah.
Again, I think that a lot of so-called ecological groups are, particularly in America, kind of reactionary in
that's also my opinion.
Yeah. So that it's a kind of romantic back to nature movement rather than a belief in kind of responsibility of
this is not a way out.
Mm, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it goes well with kind of John Wayne and the Wild West and the noble savage and.
Yes, we have the same problem in France with ecological movement, but I think it changed.
Well, yeah, I've got a friend who's a very old friend of mine, who's a geographer, who's an economic geographer, and as such is part of a sort of radical group in the geography world. And he, for years, has been kind of saying this. He, in fact, despairs of anybody ever doing anything in time. Because he was saying that it's, you know, it's like a sort of an apple, that one piece of rot can be removed. When you've got it running through the whole apple, it kind of suddenly, you know, it's a dead apple.
I've been always obsessed
mm-hmm.
by the demographic explosion.
Yeah.
Are you?
Well, I think,
for me, for instance, it's nearly impossible to live in a large town as London or Paris.
Yeah, I don't find that. I couldn't live anywhere else.
It's better in London. For instance, in the underground, in France, it's completely impossible to live.
The French underground is sort of, notorious. The New York underground too is very similar. It's noisier for one thing. I think that's part of it, and so the tension is greater. And the people.
It is not the same.
No.
I was very surprised.
London's very lucky. It's kind of just.
Yes, it's better than Paris.
I like Paris very much. Visually, Paris is considerably better than London. The traffic flow is better in Paris, but, wider streets and things like that sort of make it. But I don't know, it's partly the boys. In New York and Paris, there's a lot more traffic noise, which just, you just start getting very tense. I'd never really noticed it before. I'd spent a lot of time in New York. And I just isolated, this was late at night, this sound, which was a steady, muted roar, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And it was just the noise of the city, it was just perpetual. And you don't get that in London, it kind of, everything closes.
Silence is a very important thing for me because I am working in a petroleum refinery.
Mm.
Of course, there is a noisy factory. And in the second reason is that I work on night, on morning, or afternoon, and it is very important to sleep. And actually, I am searching for a very quiet bedroom, and it is very hard to find.
I know, I sympathize with you, I know what you mean.
I think we...
I think Hawkwind,
yes.
Haven't really. That.
Yes, I have asked this question about Hawkwind because I've seen your comics.
Oh, right, yeah.
Drawn by Cotton.
Yes, right. Hawkwind kind of got half their name from my Hawk Moon book.
Hawkmoon, yes.
But I didn't know them then, and this is really how we met. But the thing I like about Hawkwind, coming back to that, is that in the they regard themselves as a community band, and so they do a good half of their work is free. They do it for benefits of various kinds, and they identify very strongly with. With the kind of people, with their audiences in particular. They kind of mix with the audiences before they go on stage. Not as a kind of,
Yes,
they just like being part of the,
I like very much some other progressive groups, like for instance, a group, I think they are not very well known, even in them, called Egg.
Mm-hmm.
They are not far from Soft Machine.
Right, yeah.
But this is more intellectual, I love what it does, but it is not the same feeling during the show.
Yes, yeah.
And with Hawkwind, this is really...
Well, the other band, the Pink Fairies, who Hawkwind play with, that sometimes they go on as Pink Wind.
Yes.
That's another band that again, sort of as a point of principle, and they're not intellectuals, any of them.
Yes.
Or very few of them, even. It's just that they kind of, their integrity sort of depends on being part of the community. The idea of superstars and the pop, you know, thing is, they just resist it and won't have anything to do with it. And as a result, of course, they're very poor. But it gives them, you know, the feeling. It's why I get on with them, I think. You know, that in terms of ideals, general ideals, we're very close. So on stage, too, they appear to be a very heavy, apocalyptic band. But again, there's a kind of sort of direction to what they're doing, and a kind of constantly made statement, without it being an intellectual statement, which I think is... and also, of course, it's derived very heavily from science fiction, their imagery, the words and the songs and so on. It's this kind of weird paradox again, sort of peace and love and disaster, you know. That's why I enjoy working with them when I do work with them. It's my own attitude when I give talks. I gave a talk at a university last week, which was disastrous, in fact, for the people.
It's impossible to speak in universities.
I think by the time, you know, they've got so used to just sitting there,
yes,
that they won't respond at all,
yes,
except the kind of pedantic would-be, you know, literature don, kind of wants to air his own views, and that isn't what you want. I was very stoned when I went there, and I sort of fell into the place, and I said, right, you know, let's just have a talk. I mean, I wasn't being idealistic, I just, you know, wanted to see what they had to say. I think they didn't say a word.